Hey there, good people in crypto land. I'm Matt Leising. This is my podcast, Decent People. Welcome back to the conversation. So are you wondering how artificial intelligence and blockchain might intersect? Well, we are here to at Decentral. We're asking ourselves that question. So on today's show, I spoke with Sunil Shrini, who is a founding member at Ritual. What Ritual is doing is they are bridging Web3 crypto blockchain with artificial intelligence. They're in the early stages of building their own layer one blockchain that will allow people to build right on top of it, or you could bridge over to it from Ethereum or Solana or Avalanche. And what it's going to allow for is that you can integrate artificial intelligence capabilities into your decentralized app or your protocol or your blockchain in general. And so Ritual is going about this in a large part because they feel very strongly that AI should be decentralized. It should not be in the hands of a few big companies. ChatGPT and OpenAI has got a huge investment from Microsoft. There are small teams that are working on these things behind the scenes. Ritual is more about this needs to be decentralized, it needs to be open source, and it needs to be as widely available as possible so that people can make the best models that artificial intelligence is running off of. So we get into all that with Sunil, and we talk about his history at Berkeley, and talk about all the exciting things that are coming as the bear market here has turned into a bull market. So as always, thanks for being here. Thanks for your support, and I hope you enjoy the show. Hey, Sunil, how you doing? Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Good. It's great to be here. I'm excited to chat.
Yeah, me too. We've been covering more of the intersection with artificial intelligence and blockchain here at Decentral. And so I'm really excited to kind of dive into what you guys are doing. But first, like, I kind of like to start these, recently with just your kind of take on the current market and the current vibe out there in crypto. Bitcoin has hit an all-time high. ETH is close to its all-time high. There's a lot of excitement out in the general industry. How are you doing? How are you coping with it? What do you think's going on?
I wish I could be on chain more, but we have a company to build. I think it's really, really exciting. I don't think, the previous bear market was rather short, in comparison, or at least it felt short, right? And now when I sort of look at the state of it, we're kind of at a very special inflection point that kind of reminds me of DeFi summer, where that was sort of like the prelude to a lot of mass interest, right? From, I think, what people colloquially call is like retail, or maybe in a less nice word, it's like normies, but not necessarily like that, right? Where you are at this inflection point where we're starting to see a lot of capital flow back into the system, either an expectation of rate cuts or other macro overheads, right? But there's still a very high rate of innovation, right? And so largely private markets are leading of public markets. And, I think that we're starting to see, at least in the private market side, like a lot of new influx of developer activity. So for me, these are really exciting and these are great times. So I think there's going to be a lot of interesting and new narratives this cycle.
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel to like DeFi summer, because that was when I think a lot of new industries sort of understood what they could do with Web3, with NFTs, like certainly the fine arts world, jumped in with both feet. And all of a sudden you had, fine art NFTs from Beeple and all sorts of other very established artists that were, being auctioned off at Christie's and Sotheby's. And then music world kind of found out about what it could be doing with Web3 and how to sort of create a more direct relationship between a musician and a fan. And so here, and that was obviously a couple of years ago, 3 years ago now. Now it's a new industry. It's like it's finance. Like it's like we've always had DeFi, but now like the real world, like traditional financial behemoths like BlackRock and Vanguard are coming in with both feet with a Bitcoin ETF. And so I've been thinking about that a lot because lately, obviously because of the inflows and this crazy stat that BlackRock got to $10 billion in its Bitcoin ETF faster than any other ETF in history. It's now, I think Bitcoin has gone mainstream as an investment asset, as an asset class. But I'm curious if you think it has broken through in your daily life or in people that you know in their daily life? Because I'm not seeing that yet. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about that and what it might mean for Bitcoin, not just as an asset, but as a protocol, as a payment rail, as, you know, like what it was meant to be was, you know, permissionless digital cash. Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a pretty good question. I think that you kind of have to look at this in the lens of, in a very sort of like real geopolitical lens, right? We both live in the United States. I'm born and raised here, right? We have had the most stable monetary regime maybe in history, right? And so because, you know, America can be considered to be in a very post-scarcity landscape, right? There's actually not all of that need for people in America per se to use Bitcoin for daily activities beyond investment, right?
Let me jump in. That's a really great point. And I've been thinking about that too. Like, I don't think we get it in this country.
No,
like,
we don't.
We're not in Venezuela. We're not in Africa. We're not somewhere where, you know, you could either be hyperinflated out of your savings or you just don't have access to a bank.
Exactly. And I think like we are spoiled here. And I mean, you know, this is maybe endemic of a lot of things, not just in the monetary system, right? It's a whole different combo. But I think once you step outside of America and maybe step outside of the prime countries, we'll say, right? You start to see it become a lot more of a need, right? So I think in America takes on this very sovereign lens of like, this is, you know, an asset that you own. No one can take this away from you. This is becoming, you know, the new gold standard, right? It's the digital equivalent of like a scarce physical commodity, right? Because it's provably scarce. In other countries, and especially if you go to second and third world countries, because it offers a much more stable value proposition relative to their native currency, and where getting access to US dollars may be hard, but getting access to Bitcoin is a function of your, you know, internet setup, and usually they have some sort of like workaround in these countries. I think that's where you see it become very real. So a friend of mine who, you know, not even Bitcoin, but like another currency, a friend of mine who's been to Thailand recently was like, it's crazy. You can go to some parts and you can really play in different cryptos for like your taxi drivers, right? I think that payments for Bitcoin, you know, I've never really landed on how I feel for that as like a leading KPI of its adoption. I think Bitcoin of itself has a religious fever, right? A religious fervor, and that's sort of what drives it as this. But I think overall, like, in at least in my circles and every day, people value and prize Bitcoin as more of like a scarce asset that is a flight to quality when people aren't sure about the current monetary regime, right? And that is great because that is good for crypto inflows. I imagine that a lot of the inflows now are actually probably just FOMO from last cycle and people that, you know, didn't have the time or the access to go and, you know, get on chain. But I also think that if you go look at adoption by countries and you go look outside of the first world countries, you'll start to see that people actually view this as like a monetary asset, right? And even in America, we have cities that are sort of pegging a very big part of how they plan on building their infrastructure and growing around Bitcoin, like Miami, right? So,
yeah, or Colorado, pay your taxes in crypto in Colorado now, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's like one of the pillars of a currency is that you can actually use it to pay taxes. It's, I think it's actually part of the definition.
Right, exactly.
So pretty cool. All right, let me put you on the spot one last time here and then we'll move on. But so Bitcoin is like kind of right at its all-time high, 69,000-ish. ETH is approaching its all-time high at 4,000. How do you square the two? Like how they're so different in price and value? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you, or do you think they should be more on a parity or less disparate? I guess.
Yeah, I think there's like two things that you have to sort of reconcile, right? Which is like these assets these currencies as mimetic assets, and then these currencies in terms of like how can you understand their real value flows, right? ETH is super, super interesting because I think a lot of people that will look at ETH will be like, okay, all of the activities on ETH, you know, it should, you know, be on parity with Bitcoin, right, et cetera. And that may be true, right? In reality, we see a lot of exciting narratives around sort of like supercharging the value of ETH, right? Whether it's restaking using the base ETH chain to bootstrap new securities via Eigenlayer, right? And Ritual sort of had a partnership announcement around that, or the glut of L2s and even L3s based on them, which eventually like value flows to ETH, right? Even if, you know, it's becoming very, very cheap to build on top thanks to things like EIP 4844. But I think what Bitcoin has sort of over ETH is two things, right? People really, really index memetically on this idea of provable scarcity. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. We see massive market events around each halving, right? With Ethereum, it's a lot more stochastic in the way that 1559 works, right? You have like a perpetual sort of like block reward. And then depending on sort of, you know, the utilization, like you either burn more ETH or you, you know, don't, right? You know, ETH can be deflationary or inflationary at any given time. What does this mean for price parity? I think that Bitcoin just has a much more, a much stronger memetic value prop. And that's sort of what's led into it, right? It's been around longer. People use this as a stable reserve currency. In fact, maybe to be facetious, the fact that Bitcoin is not being used as the lifeblood to power applications on top, right? At least not until recently with all these Bitcoin L2s, is maybe part and why the reason that it's gone and been seen as a commodity, right? You wouldn't use maybe gold for microtransactions, right? To power applications built on top. Yeah, you make jewelry and stuff like that, but the ultimate value for that still ends up being the gold. And I see that sort of as the commodity framing for people.
Yeah, no, that's a great way of putting it. And I think you kind of nailed it there where Bitcoin has a cap. It's got 21 million Bitcoin. And then ETH has introduced this, you know, burning mechanism. So it can, like you said, it can be deflationary at some points. Other times it can be inflationary. I think that's a little harder for people to wrap their heads around and maybe harder to model. but yeah. Let's keep an eye on it because I think things are gonna they're gonna go a little bit
up
here. And I think we got a little ways to go.
I do think ETH BTC will be very interesting to watch over the next few months.
Yeah. All right. So one thing I wanted to bring up, we both went to UC Berkeley. We're both Cal Bears. Tell me a little bit about your experience there. Were you there at a time when crypto was kind of out there, or what were you doing there, and what years were you in school at Cal?
So it's really interesting because most of my crypto journey has actually been during school. I was working full-time most of it. So this is a really, really, I graduated May 23, technically. This is probably the most interesting. So I went to Berkeley because I grew up on the East Coast and I wanted to go somewhere where more out of the box paths were well accepted, right? You grew up on the East Coast, it's very doctor, banker, lawyer, you know, you name it, right? And Berkeley feel like that right mix because obviously, you know, elite public school, but also phenomenal, you know, academics. And so you kind of get a mix of everyone from every walk of life. The unfortunate thing in the moment and the fortunate thing in hindsight was that when I got to Berkeley, I was actually not even studying computer engineering, which I ended up completing my degree in. I was studying mechanical engineering, but I got really, really interested in distributed learning just randomly, right? And federated learning. And I realized that there was actually a lot of really, really interesting angles around how this interplayed with both cryptographic primitives and then game theoretic primitives, right? And constructions and schemes. And so as a result of that, I was like, you know, I was reading some more edge research on like how some of those coordination games could be on a blockchain. I ended up reading the Bitcoin and Ethereum sort of white papers and yellow papers. And I joined blockchain at Berkeley, which is has been a preeminent club in the space. Turned out many, many fantastic founders that were in the space. So like, you know, Sunny from Osmosis, the guys from Evmos, you know, Zubin, who started Open, a bunch of, right, them. And I was doing blockchain at Berkeley and then COVID hit when I was a freshman. So I got sent home in March. This is exactly the time I was getting into like DeFi and crypto. And that's when the money printer turned on, right? Rates started going really, really low and things started going really high. So it's a really interesting thing where it was like, I was kind of at home. At the time I was actually doing MO work for, you know, if you've ever had anything refrigerated in the United States, it went through this company called Lineage Logistics. So I was doing MO and optimization for them. And, it was a really interesting time where I was also just spending most of my time doing, you know, outside of that, being on chain and building, right? Or you know, trying out protocols. And at the same time, this was really popping off, right? This was DeFi summer. We had the money printer on. And that's where I ended up looking into some more esoteric constructions I was really interested in at the time in on-chain interest rate swaps, which are very sort of, I think, premature and never really took off. But I was looking into that. I met through another organization that Niraj, who was a GP at Blockchain, one of the co-founders at Ritual, and he was like, hey, like, what are you doing, you know, when you go back to school? And I was like, well, I'll just be sitting at home in Jersey doing classes, being nothing. I'll probably try and go work. And he was like, yeah, you want to come work at Blockchain? And I think that was sort of the start of everything.
That's really cool. And Yeah, for folks who don't know, Polychain is a huge investor in the space. It was there very early. What was it like going to Polychain? And like, did you just get thrown in the deep end and sort of like, okay, good luck? Like, or what? How, what were you doing, research, or what would they ask you to do first off?
A little bit, in the best possible way. They first asked me to do research for the venture side, sort of identifying interesting theses. So funny enough, for those of you who are tweeting in because they're interested in crypto AI, the first report I ever wrote on Polychain in September 2020 was on distributed intelligence markets. I covered Upshot, BitTensor, which took 4 years and 3 years to come into the mainstream. The first pass or Numerai, the first version of Upshot was based on sort of a game theoretic mechanism to coordinate intelligent agents to converge on certain value or appraisal, something like that. So then Numerai and then Erasure Bay, which was Numerai's sort of information bounty protocol. And then from there, I sort of like spent a lot of time thinking about infrastructure, bridging, DeFi. And then later on in my term, I spent and used my nascent data science and engineering skills for some of their more liquid strategies, but primarily research and venture.
Yeah, cool. So before we get to your time in Jersey, did you end up going, you were able to go back to Berkeley and graduate like in person and stuff?
Yeah. So I never quit school while doing this, although maybe some of my friends at this company otherwise had wished I did. To me, I think it was very, very important to have that anchor of a different life entirely from crypto because it's so subsuming. And I think doing it was the best thing I ever did. The economics obviously were great and there were only a few classes I was really interested in, but I think they made a markup, I think. But more importantly, it was just to be in that environment. I ended up making a lot of friends who were on similar paths where they were doing things really out of the norm, not necessarily in crypto, but in AI or hardware manufacturing and stuff like that. And I think those ended up becoming some of my close friends. So also learning from their journeys was great. So, I was at Polychain and then I was sort of freelancing for a bunch of protocols, was going to go join Open and then ended up being reached out to by Dragonfly. So I joined their investment team for a short while and then left and was on the founding team of a company called Alchemia, which is still going. They were building sort of financial products for Bitcoin miners. And then took a little bit of a break, became a partner at Accomplice, which is a fund. I'm still a venture partner, and then Ritual sort of started towards my tail end. And throughout all of that, I was doing school. And by doing school, maybe leeching off my friends a little bit, but still enjoying it all.
Right on. Last question. Where's your favorite place to eat in Berkeley?
Okay. Great China. It's down on Bancroft, like right past. It is, if you can get a spot, because it's always crowded. You can go on a Wednesday and it's packed and you have like an hour away. But it is the best Chinese food I've had at the Bay. So that. And then if it's late night, probably Gypsies.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go in with Top Dog.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah, that was always that was a staple of mine. All right. So you grew up in New Jersey. Were your parents into tech or science? Or like, tell me about that. Like, were you always into it? Or how did you sort of get on this path?
Yeah, my dad did some tech and trading at a bank. I hated computer science, math, and finance growing up as a result of it.
Oh, yeah.
I was good at it, but I think there's always that kid pushback. It's like the old man said something and you don't want to do it. So funny enough,
exactly.
And my mom used to be in fashion and then, spent some more time raising me and my sister. I was always just very, very interested by mechanical things. Still am. Still love, learning how watches and cars work. So I grew up in Jersey. I went to a school that I was privileged to go to that swapped out traditional electives with engineering courses in either mechanical or electrical engineering. So I took mechanical. I thought for sure that I was going to, build drones or build race cars or something. But I came to college and I eventually realized that, I really just liked the math part of all of this and more, and then maybe, inherited more from my mom, but I also just really liked knowing how people worked, right? And sort of how to coordinate them. And when you kind of merge the idea of like, how can you combine mathematical primitives with how can you make coordination happen, right? You end up at a very interesting intersection or how do you, understand people where it's like, you can use mathematical primitives to, mimic intelligence, right? Which is sort of AI, right? And you can use it to do coordination games, which is like game theory, right? And I realized I like that a lot more. So studying sort of like, the theoretical side of computer science and he was a lot more conducive to that. But it was then when I did it that I was like, okay, wait, this math, finance, and CS like combo is pretty cool, right? And that's what it was. So funny enough, like, if anything, I think, you know, I grew up sort of on a very different bend, intent on doing it, and ended up converging because I realized that's what I liked more. But yeah.
Did you, I think maybe Stanford gets a little more linked to, you know, Sand Hill Road and the VC world, but I think that's probably pretty prevalent at Berkeley as well. Did that, how attuned do you with, you know, like Silicon Valley and what was going on over there? Were you interested in that from the get-go, or were you more kind of your head was down and you were, like you just said, into the mechanical kind of stuff and then the people aspect of it all?
No, I was very in tune with it. I think there's one thing I didn't touch on is like growing up in Jersey, like I said, you don't really get a lot of exposure to people doing out of the box things. It's very sort of like hard coded conventional prestige careers, right? And they obviously are, you know, great options, right? But it just wasn't for me. And so as soon as I got to Berkeley, the first organization I joined was called Contrary, which was a student at the time, a venture fund that had student scouts. Contrary's ended up how I ended up meeting actually Niraj, funny enough, because he was housemates with one of the partners there. And then another good friend who was at Contrary is also now a partner at another quite big VC fund in the crypto space. But they were very general. And that was like a very, very good seg into sort of entrepreneurship at the university. So I spent a lot of time basically talking to other student founders sort of from the get-go, from freshman year, first semester, you know, whether they're undergrads, graduate students, professors. And that sort of gave me a lot of time into that ecosystem. I also spent time working with Free Ventures, which was like the on-campus incubator at Berkeley. Spent a lot of time being mentored by House Fund, which is like Berkeley's venture thing, and really sort of got a sense for how the entrepreneurship ecosystem there worked and then how to build a company, right? And Berkeley has phenomenal resources for those. And then, you know, the crypto thing kind of happened in parallel where it's like, you can sort of know all of this, but then to go and build it, you need to really love what you're doing. You need to be able to make sure that whatever you're building any given time, like you'd be okay doing that for the rest of your life, right? Do it well. And so to me, crypto became that thing. And it was very interesting because then, you know, it went from understanding how, you know, capital flows and venture flows and companies are built in traditional industries. And then you go into crypto and it's a completely different paradigm, right? But I always was very attracted to that. And to me, crypto was like one of the fields that was at the most edge and the field that ended up touching a lot of the things I really liked working on.
So it sounds like you might have missed the ICO kind of craze back in 2017.
I was young.
a little early for you. Yeah, and like, but that's immediately what came to mind when you say that, because crypto does have these paradigms where you can just go out and raise money from, you know, people who want to buy your coin. At least that was a very prevalent, you know, method back in the day. I think VC stuff has come back a lot more. And I'm curious, with your experience as a venture capitalist and working in these different firms, can you just kind of pull the curtain back a little bit and tell us, like, what are you guys really looking for? Like, what are the things that get you excited about a project that comes across your desk? Is it the team? Is it the people? Is it the idea? Is it a combination of these things? Or is it, okay, we can exit from this in 7 years, you know, like, to be cynical, like, what really kind of like makes the hair stand up on your neck, you know, when you see somebody come through that is asking for money?
It depends on the firm. So I can only speak to the way I think about it, largely these days through sort of like Compass, but also a lot of this translates over to like, how do you bootstrap an ASIC ecosystem for Ritual, right? And I think the ultimate thing is always like, I always place a very strong emphasis on the capabilities of the team. This does not always correspond to historical track record, but rather the immense clarity of first principles thinking, right? My favorite self-point saying is that I'll never put a probability on a piece of technology or product being realized, but rather a probability on a set of humans realizing them, right? And I think that's really, really important. And then that needs to coincide with sort of like the market opportunity, right? You can have the best team in the world, but when you think about venture scale returns, if they're operating in markets that are not conducive to venture scale returns, right? It's very, very, very hard to sort of justify that, right?
Yeah, I think that's a huge issue still to this day is scale, right? And in blockchains,
exactly.
It's just scale is really tough. Nobody's quite figured it out as far as I can tell. All right, cool. And then so moving on to Ritual and what you guys are doing there, which is very much about artificial intelligence, AI. When did AI sort of, I guess you were doing those reports that you mentioned for Polychain back in the day. So you have been sort of cognizant of this for a while, but so did like ChatGPT and what, you know, happened about a year or so ago, did that surprise you, or were you just like, oh, finally, you know, I've been waiting for this? Yeah. Cause it seemed like, you know, it seemed like it was just kind of in the shadows, and then it all of a sudden just burst into, you know, the mainstream.
A little bit of both, I would say. I think that, you know, if you sort of paid attention to the research that was coming out, right, you knew that there were products that do this, like GPT-2 existed. So for me, it was like both a finally moment because it hit the retail, and then I was surprised at how quickly it got adopted, right? It turns out that all you needed was an interface for people to interact with the thing, and then that's sort of what they wanted, right? And an API to integrate into their applications.
Yeah.
So for me, it was really interesting, but I think what was like even more interesting was that coincided with the release of ChatGPT in October, what was it, like 20? It was October 20th. I want to say 2022, right?
Yeah,
So, you know, the release of ChatGPT with that, it coincided nicely with a sort of like the part of the bear where, you know, you have a lot of noise washed out, and then there's just a few people building, right?
Well, FTX was just like burning to the ground at that moment, wasn't
right.
it? Right.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I think that was like the hellfire that like just started burning, and see us all, a lot of people flee the ecosystem, right?
Right, and all of a sudden AI was the new shiny thing.
Exactly. And AI was a new shiny thing. And I think it was until like February 23, right, where it was sort of like flushed out. And then like, you know, AI was like the really crazy thing. We started seeing things heat up. And then I think like the intersection of those two lagged, right, the adoption of those two. But for me, seeing ChatGPT and seeing the explosion of interest, and then suddenly people were paying attention to like what was going on in Hugging Face, and you had a bunch of companies coming out with models, right? And there was a bunch of raises for these things. I was like, oh yeah, like there's enough activity and warrants there where people are going to start really paying attention to this intersection. I think like starting that summer of 23, going into the fall, is when BitTensor started getting a sort of traction, right? And or not traction, but a lot of interest, along with a lot of the decentralized compute networks, as people were looking to sort of expose themselves to the space. Even now, it's really, really funny to look at it and see that a lot of investors that don't typically allocate to crypto cannot actually get a lot of good liquid exposure to AI outside of like the big tech stocks, right? So a lot of sort of like more interesting edge plays in crypto and AI have sort of like taken a little bit of that liquidity, right?
Interesting.
And I think it'll continue to be that way, right? Because if you look at the way that traditional capital cycles work for AI companies, right, it's a very prolonged period where they get acquired or they go through IPO, right?
Well, they're now back to just to like make it simple. Like if I wanted to get exposure to OpenAI, I can't really do that.
Right? Microsoft, right? That would be your best bet, right?
Yeah, which is very
exactly.
Yeah. then I'm investing in Clippy.
So, yeah,
not sure I want to do that. Clippy, the little Microsoft mascot. Anyway, so now tell me, give me your elevator pitch for Ritual. And what you guys are doing, and how you're combining the crypto world and the AI world, and why you think it's important.
Cool. So Ritual is a sovereign execution layer for AI. What does that mean? We want to build the most expressive infrastructure to connect sort of any on-chain workflows and merge the best of the game theoretic and cryptographic primitives we've seen in crypto with you know, a bunch of AI operations. What Ritual looks like today, the first phase is Infranet, which is a AI-optimized decentralized Oracle network. This means that any smart contract is the first product of its kind that lets any smart contract access any sort of AI model off-chain, as long as there's a node to service that. What we'll be unveiling more details about slowly is the eventual Ritual chain, which is going to be its own sovereign layer. And what does it actually mean to be a sovereign layer for AI in that case? Well, it turns out that if you look at the way that you can develop certain custom sort of execution environments based on existing ones, you can add in functionality around AI operations. So for those who are watching that are familiar, for example, that may look like a stateful precompile for inference. That means that the actual native execution client can go and coordinate with like maybe another container server to call inference, right? And maybe overly simplified terms. This means that you'll be able to call inference to any model on the network with a few lines of smart contract code for anyone developing natively on Ritual. And other chains will still be able to go and access that sort of like AI co-processing via, you know, any sort of general message passing protocol. So you'll be able to do two things, which is like AI-enabled dApps and then crypto-enabled AI. And I can talk more about those.
Okay. But bigger picture, it's all open source. And this is all a public kind of infrastructure that you're building.
Yep.
And you call it the Ritual Superchain now. I don't know if that's what you're describing. That's the second step, I think. To be honest, to me, it sounds really complicated. but it sounds like you guys are like intentionally building something that is very, it seems like you're trying to make it robust, but you're also, you have to kind of build it yourselves. And then like, I think if I'm hearing you correctly, you're allowing smart contracts or a protocol or an app to connect then to what you guys are building at Ritual to access AI in one direction, or like you said, maybe AI functionality with crypto on the other side. Is that, am I getting that right?
Mm-hmm. The end goal is to do a bi-directional bridge, right? Right now, anyone can go and run an Infinet node, put a model on that node, right? Have that model start serving inference requests on chain. And we already have a lot of interesting partners that we're going to be announcing that are going to be using this for technology, right? For example, like, I'll keep that as a surprise because it should go out pretty soon.
Oh man, we almost broke
it. Yeah, almost. Almost got me. But there's the other side of this, right? There's AI-enabled dApps. You can do a lot of really interesting things there, right? You could have, plug and play for recommendation algorithms with something like Farcaster. You could have on-chain lending protocols that use AI agents in the loop to parameterize certain risk parameters, right? You could have models that do long-tail asset appraisal for things like NFTs, right? That previously weren't accessible, and there's actually some use cases of that. You could have generative AI that mints into NFTs, and you can crowdsource people's inputs for what should actually be minted, right? And then there's this whole sector of like crypto-enabled AI. And what does that mean? It's like, how does this actually work in the benefit of AI, right? And probably the one that's talked about most is like verifiable machine learning, how to use different proofs to make sure that what someone sent you as like an AI output is actually what was generated by the model and was not tampered with, right? But I think there's also so many more interesting angles, right? We can use a lot of interesting primitives around the same proving stack to prove that like a piece of data was, you know, used to, you know, train a model. And depending on how much that data made an impact and sort of the end model performance, you can basically, you know, say whoever gets that data is entitled to like royalties or like a piece of like monetization from the model, right? You can have DAOs that control models and crowdsource responses and use that to basically tune a model to be on the preference of its, you know, of the users of the DAO, right? Things like that are also really important. Those things will all be possible via Ritual's infrastructure. So not just injecting AI into apps, but building protocols around models themselves.
Yeah, and it seems to me, I was talking to Paul Brody, he's at Ernst & Young, and he's like their blockchain, he's their global blockchain lead. And they're working on this problem where they want the database of information that an AI is being trained on to be something that's been verified by a blockchain, yeah, right? So all the sources could be, you know, as simple as something like a New York Times article or, you know, a research paper or something where the facts are the facts. And it's because the issue I think here is with AI, you can pull any amount of shit from the internet that's, you know, wildly false or whatever and use that to train your model. So, you know, garbage in, garbage out, right? But, and we're going to, we already have that and we're always going to have that. But I think what needs to be done and what kind of Paul was talking to me about was there's another way. Like you can have a data set that you're pulling from that's verified and that's where a blockchain implementation can come in. Is that sort of what you guys are getting at a very high level? Or like, talk to me about that, where the data sources, is that where the blockchain, the on-chain element to what you guys are trying to do is kind of coming from at this point?
So it's definitely one thing that's enabled, right? If you want to use on-chain as a provenance structure for data that goes in, that's one use case, right? And I think that's a really interesting use case because we already start to see people care a lot more about like knowing what kind of data went into a model, right? Maybe even more so into knowing that a model wasn't tampered with. But when I say crypto-enabled AI, I think the design space is so much more plentiful, right? To give a very simple example, there is a certain model technique called reinforcement learning with human feedback. What this basically does, in abstract, is you have a model, it generates a bunch of outputs, and then you'll have someone go and sort of rank those outputs. And it sort of creates like an ELO system, right, for each model generations. Over time, you can use that ELO to sort of train it on that user's preference. So you really tune it, right, based on like how they perceive outputs generated for the same prompt. You can do this in a distributed setting, right? You can have a DAO that collectively votes on ranking based on sort of like a stake-weighted ranking, right? If they put up some sort of stake to vote, that basically helps you crowdsource feedback on an existing base model. And then the DAO basically says like, okay, we like these prompts more than these prompts. And then you can use that to train the model. And suddenly what do you have? You have a DAO that has fine-tuned their own model based on the sum set of their users' preferences, right? And that's really powerful because now, in essence, like obviously there's a lot more detail into the hosting of this model and the access to this model. But in essence, you have this model that represents a DAO. It's almost like a crowd-owned model, right? One of the partners we're working with is building really interesting technology about letting anyone easily create AI personas out of models and letting others invest in them. Right. And they want to do that incentive system on chain. And you can have people to actually take stakes in the models that they use. Right. I think these are the things that are really important. There's no value flow to the end user currently in the current like centralized AI landscape.
Yeah. And when we're talking about this, you guys say that you guys allow Ritual allows anyone to integrate AI into your app, or your protocol or your chain. But you're not creating the AI itself. Am I right in that?
That's like right.
AI is you're helping bridge the two, but you're not like a large language model yourself or whatever.
That's right. Yeah, we work with a lot of awesome collaborators that are building the full range of AI. Right. I think it's also important to recognize that AI is not just large language models or image generation. Right. Even things as simple as regression models or tree based models and machine learning are very, very useful and applicable and are still used in most cases, especially in most on-chain use cases, right? We build the connective infrastructure to link those models on-chain and vice versa.
Okay. How are you guys dealing with data on-chain? Because I know that's a big issue. There's just not a lot of space on the blockchain for data. So we can get into the eigenlayer in a minute, but is that your solution or how are you guys thinking about that?
Yeah. In terms of data for training models, we don't also touch like the training workflows currently, right? What we do is that we really are focused on connecting like the end product, which is the models, with sort of applications that need to use them and extending a lot of expressivity around that. So a lot of the data that we deal with falls under like three categories, right? Which is outputs, right? Like the actual outputs of these models, input set on chain, and then like any proofs that may be attached to them, right? But not necessarily the training data, which I think is maybe like the bulk of what you're referring to, right? So the chain can sort of like, scale up to maybe accommodate this data, but it gets expensive. So we are sort of exploring what solutions look like with, data availability providers where we can actually just go and post this data to them, cheaply. As for training data that goes into actually creating these models, we don't, currently touch that. That's, more side the side of the model creators.
Okay. So let's look into the future and let's say that you guys have all these big pieces in place. You're your own chain kind of over here. And then I'm on Ethereum or Solana or Avalanche and I am bridging to you to do what you guys do with AI. And then the bridge is going both ways. Is that sort of the big picture idea?
Yeah, we'll have general message passing protocols implemented so that you can use, Ritual's native sort of like, you can use Ritual both as a sovereign chain, but also as an AI co-processor for other chains, right? And use generated inferences on the Ritual chain on other chains.
I could be launching my app on Ritual as an L1 kind of idea?
Or you could launch your app on Ethereum and still use Ritual for like its inference capabilities or any other AI operations. For the immediate term, we do continue to support Infernet on, we do plan on supporting Infernet on other chains, at least you know, in the short term, as because it's still, you know, a bit of a ways until we can get out virtual chain. In supporting sort of like Infranet, you know, these applications will continue to be able to use the on-chain Infranet software development kit to access the off-chain networks of nodes that are supporting inference requests. So you can build on Infranet today. You can use AI models today. We have applications that have already been built on it, are currently building, et cetera. And we continue to support that for the short to medium term.
Okay. And then for the ritual, like L1, do you plan to have a coin or a token or something? Or is that where Eigenlayer comes in? Or help me understand that.
Yeah, so a lot of that's a work in progress. So cannot, you know, legally say anything around that. But where Eigenlayer comes in is Eigenlayer provides a very interesting distribution to a set of experienced node operators, right? So what we unlock for Eigenlayer node operators is that they have access to compute like GPUs, right? Even today, even with Infranet today, right? They can start contributing that to serve model inference for applications that want to use them or are willing to pay to use them, right? So it unlocks sort of AI native yield flows for Eigenlayer operators that are not previously seen. And then in the future, you know, as we think about sort of rolling out the chain, it's important that we're able to bootstrap it with a high level of security and decentralization from the get-go, right? And having access to the Eigenlayer operator set gives us access to a bunch of these operators that will be able to do it. And sort of regardless of sort of what function that looks like in terms of like what asset is used to secure that, Eigenlayer supports, you know, a full spectrum of it. So we're very excited to work with them.
And yeah, just for folks who might not know, Eigenlayer is a way, so Ethereum is now proof of stake and it's secured by people who have staked 32 ETH to help secure the network and get a chance to, you know, order the next block of transactions. And then what Eigenlayer is doing is coming in and saying, well, that ETH that's just sitting there staking can be used for another application, and it can help secure something else in the Ethereum kind of universe. And that's what you're talking about, where so Eigenlayer could be used for stakers who elect to help Ritual, right? Like they could pledge through it that their stake would also be helping to secure Ritual. Do I have that right?
That could be one venue we go for. Like I said, a lot of that's a work in progress. Eigenlayer ABSs are also able to accept other assets and basically just have the same node operators use those other assets as both payment streams and an economic base for staking. So okay. It's not constrained to ETH.
Okay. Does that sort of like double collateral use worry you guys at all? Have you had that discussion about, you know, there's the ETH that's like staking for the Beacon chain on Ethereum, but then it can be sort of used secondarily to stake or to help secure other projects. Is that a concern? Is that one thing that I've sort of struggled with? I think Eigenlayer is a very interesting idea, but I wonder if it needs to be that complicated.
Right. I think that at the end of the day, it ends up being a very node level decision. Eigenlayer doesn't enforce any constraints around sort of what nodes opt to and what they don't, right? So a node could be staking for like 50 different services, or it could be staking for two different services, right? And I think that, you know, from a system design perspective, I think the Eigenlayer team has put out a lot of sort of like work on this. And so obviously I'll defer to them as the experts here. But from my perspective, I think that you have to really view sort of like the risk as an end user from a more node level decision, right? Whereas like, if you know that a node operator historically has been able to service all of its, you know, has been able to act in good faith and be reliant for all the services that it's validated for, right? And maybe, you know, it's not too many services, or maybe they've been a really good job doing a lot of services, then, you know, that historical track record is probably much more important to an end user to figuring out who to restake with, right? And do that with. And so, yeah, you know, I think with all things, when you think about sort of like Eigenlayer using, you know, at stake and restaking it or rehypothecating it for other services, for the end user, it's much more important to understand, you know, who they're sort of like trusting if they're going to, you know, go and stake with this person. Because each operator in very high likelihood will be staking for a different number of services, right? In that sense that they don't, or, you know, do uniformity.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I just hope if there's a huge shock in the system that it doesn't sort of create a domino effect where people have to be pulling stuff out and then, you know, you've got margin calls and bad stuff happening deep within the system. So let's go like to AI in general. You know, everyone from my son and my friends, like when we get into this discussion, it always comes down to like, oh my God, is it going to take over the world? You know, is it going to be a Terminator kind of situation with Skynet? I'm sure you have these conversations with your friends and family too. And how do you explain to them about AI and its capabilities right now in a very like broad sense?
Right. Yeah, this is like the $1 million question, right? Like, are we all doomed?
Like, what are they doing over there at where they're building those robot dogs?
Yeah. Boston Dynamics.
fuck, man, can't you just leave that alone?
Yeah, I do. I have seen some people use them as pets and as a skit in like TikTok, that is probably not the direction they expected it would go.
Well, you don't have to feed them. You don't have to clean up after them. Yeah. I can see that appeal.
They can do little tricks. They're kind of cute, I guess. where do I see AI going? It's a really interesting question. I'm going to reframe the question. Where do I think AI should not go? I don't think AI personally, right? These are my personal views. I don't think AI should go the way of a few companies being in control of them. Not from any sort of like highly ideological, oh, we need to like get, you know, value users, we need to democratize, but from a very real sense that when you rely on small internal teams to do alignment, right? You are basically relying on a team that may not be a good representation of like the entire populace to align this AI, right? And it ends up being a very, very dangerous political or ideological weapon. Probably prime recent example of this is what happened with Google Gemini, right? They probably had their own sort of internal safety team that, you know, fine-tuned and red-teamed their AI. And as a result, you know, it sort of exhibited probably undesirable behavior, right?
They were turning out images of the founding fathers.
That's a whole other discussion, so we won't go into that. But
it's a really great point, because when you get those small teams, that their biases are going to be right in there. And you can't, human beings are going to bring their biases to whatever they're doing. So yeah, that's a great point.
Now let's look at this on like the nation state scale. There's a lot of countries that ChatGPT is banned, right? Because it's viewed as an import of Western ideology, right? If you go look where a lot of countries, especially like, for example, in the Middle East, right, with Qatar and Falcon have been allocating their resources, it's to create more locally aligned models, to create models that are more aligned with the local user, everything from lexicon to ideology to value, right? There's a company in India that just got a significant amount of venture funding to build models that are more aligned with the Indian diaspora, right, and the local Indian thing. It's not just a matter of sort of like how we construe political ideologies inside. It's also a matter that like there's a very real consideration. Eventually, you kind of want your AI best optimized for the communities that use them. From that end, I think that, you know, so maybe I'm talking my own book here, but I do really believe that the right substrata to capture this idea of localized AI is sort of on this like credibly neutral, you know, sovereign layer, right? Where, you know, personally, I believe that, you know, AI should not be gated. I think people should be able to access what models that they want. But there should also be expressivity for people to, you know, or for local sort of like, for local preferences to be captured, right? And so, you know,
Do you think it's going to get to a point where it's kind of like the news today, where you're like, I need to vet my sources. Like, I know what Fox News is going to give me. I know what CNN going to give me, the Times. That's going to be our reality with AI, right?
Absolutely. I think it's going to be very, very important to be able to do that. I think we're just getting started. I think this is why governments have been so insistent on sort of in certain parts of the world about like making sure users only use their locally aligned AI, right? For trying to maybe counteract AI as a vector for ideology from other parts of the world, right?
And I would imagine someplace like China is not even allowing it at all.
Nope. Yeah. No. They're trying to work on their sort of like own internal models, et cetera. Right. Because it is you know an important vector, I think that Yeah, it's a very interesting question, right? Like, will age, you know, AI kill us? What does AGI look like, right? In reality, there's a lot of like very real practical structural barriers to this, right? Where even if OpenAI, for example, achieves AGI, at the end of the day, that AGI is not going to
be... Tell us what AGI is, just so we know.
Yeah, AGI artificial is. General intelligence, right? It's this notion that we'll have some system of AI that can basically do, you know, a lot of things that humans can do just better, right? There's also just a very loose definition of AGI, right? And I think if you ask everyone, they have different definitions of what AGI looks like, right? And I'm happy to go into maybe what mine looks like, but there's very real structural barriers. If OpenAI achieves, you know, quote unquote AGI, that model at the end of the day is still going to have safeguards or biases that allow it to be compliant and complicit with the regime in which it operates in, which is the American regime, right? That model is not necessarily going to be well adapted for the Middle East or Asia, right? Mm-hmm. And as a result, it becomes a very real thing that people will not necessarily have access to this. I think this is why open model development is important. And this is why building a system where people can go and tweak these models to become expressive over, you know, the users that they serve is important.
Yeah, and that's a really compelling, I think, pitch that you're making with Ritual is that you want to decentralize this so it's not in the hands of a handful of people who, you know, have their biases come into it and affect the output. All right, good. So I think I'm hearing that AI is not going to become sentient on its own and is not going to try to kill us.
It might be. Hopefully it's nice.
Yeah, it might be. You're hedging. No hedging. Also, you know, in a Terminator kind of situation, we need to have invented time travel too. So that's another big deal.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that that's happening anytime soon.
That one's a lot harder.
All right. Well, Sunil, this has been really fun, man. Thank you so much for educating me and just telling me your story and talking about all these awesome things. Let people know how they can learn more about Ritual, about AI, about crypto, about what you guys are doing, and how they can kind of follow you as things progress.
Yeah, please. So if you go to RitualNet on Twitter, RitualNet, we post a lot of our updates on our Twitter account. Our website is ritual.net. We have documentation that makes it very, very easy if you're interested in participating in the network to run a node. It's very easy. You don't need a GPU or model to just get the node running. And if you do, there's a Discord link on our website. We'd be happy to help you in there. We have a lot of really exciting announcements that are going to be showcasing a lot of these new use cases that I've talked about. And I think, you know, just more broadly, we live in a really, really exciting time. Make sure that you are curated about your information sources. And just try and pay a good amount of attention to what's happening in both the AI and crypto ecosystems. The best ways to sort of like keep track of what's being funded and released. You'll see there's a lot of interesting things and, you know, if I hope anything, maybe this inspires at least one of the viewers to go and build in the space or spend a lot of time, because I think it's really important.
Yeah, man. Great advice and a great place to leave this. Again, Sunil, thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. It's been awesome.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for joining us. And make sure to subscribe and rate us at Spotify, Amazon Music, and Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Decent People is a production of Decentral Media. It is produced by Curtis Fritsch, with music by Brian Duncan and Kareem Ives.